So thank you very much. In our next session now, high dynamic range, standards and practices, an introduction, and I'm going to give a little intro to HDR and kind of where we are at the moment, and then these very fine gentlemen who represent some of the finest manufacturers of HDR equipment, we've got some good questions for them to maybe give us a bit more detail, and of course. Hang around afterwards, because outside we've got the ISO 1000 Candela panel, which is every bit as good, and we would say even better than the Sony X300. So if you're after a high-end HDR grading display, you should look at that. The leader, LV5490, again, it's the only choice if you need waveform monitoring for HDR. And Kevin and Lewis will both be showing you their products, which I'm not as familiar with as I am with Kevin and Victor's. So here we are. Here's our panel. I'm Jerry and Alex's colleague from down south, from that Ponzi Media London bubble. But I run Jigsaw Media Entertainment Systems Integration Projects. Infrastructure, wiring, color calibration, those kind of things. Sort of traditional broadcast engineering, I suppose, is me. And I'll let the other chaps introduce themselves. Kevin Salvage over at the other end there.
Hi, I'm Kevin Selge from LIDA, Japanese-based test and measurement company, celebrating 65 years this year in the industry. So we know a bit about transitions and moving the industry forward, so look forward to talking to you in the next few minutes.
I'm Lewis Brown. I work for Atomos. We make monitor recorders, and we capture RAW and ProRes and DNX from cameras, and we have HDR displays and colour management.
I'm Kevin King. I'm from AJA Video Systems. You probably know us from making converters, the corner cards, other type of capture cards in the industry. We also now have many frame sinks and frame and HDR converters.
I'm Victor Aberdeen from ISO. You're okay if you pronounce it ISO. That seems to be more of a European thing. It means image. We're actually 50 years old next month. So I'm only 8 years older than the company. We make colour accurate monitors from the HDR reference monitor that Phil described down through P3, Rec 709 and even into Adobe and Bokra for other mediums. So I have monitors that are doing grading, quality control and soft proofing for Vogue. So it's all about accurate colour consistency. So very simple.
So this is a photograph that I took at Alexandra Palace. The world's first regular high-definition television service was inaugurated here by the BBC 2nd of November 1936. And here's you thinking that Sky Plus back in 2005 was the start of regular high-definition. But what this tells us is that what's considered high-definition or high-end television has been a moving target. Of course, what this is referring to is the 40-line mechanical televisor that John Logie Baird invented. That was used by the BBC in the late 20s, early 30s, throughout London, a few thousand subscribers. And if you get a chance, go on YouTube and look at some of the recordings that people have managed to reconstitute. And full frame, full face, you can just about tell if it's a man or a woman that you're looking at. But very low resolution. But interestingly, it was a television service that used to be delivered over the phone network. And who imagined that you could ever have media delivered over the same lines that bring the phone into your house? But anyway, moving on, 405 line television, electronic television, CCIR system A, that's kind of got to be quite early, hasn't it? Has a gamma of 2.2, monochrome with 50 interlaced fields. 625 line, CCIR system B, gamma of 2.2, again, monochrome, 50 interlaced fields. 65 line PAL, a gamma of 2.2, subcarrier 4.43, eventually leading to Rec 601 video back in the early 80s. And then, in the early 90s, Rec 709, 1080 lines, a gamma of 2.2. Well, it was assumed it had a gamma of 2.2 up until just a few years ago when we realised that actually it had a more complicated gamma, Rec 1886 all along. But 2.2 was a very good approximation. And so you've got to say to yourself, what's magic about a gamma of 2.2? In fact, what is a gamma? What's that all about? Well, back when they were figuring out how to do electronic television using cathode ray tubes in the 1930s, they realised that a cathode ray tube doesn't have a linear response. If you double the amount of signal being applied to the tube, you don't get twice the amount of light out of the front of the tube. It has a gamma response. And if you look at that diagram there, you can see that the blue curve at the bottom is the typical kind of CRT gamma response with video levels in the bottom and brightness up along the y-axis. And so for a popular entertainment medium, they were going to have to do something such that all the people at home, when they watch television, it looked sensible. And so they apply an inverse gamma, the red curve, to all the television cameras in existence, which, of course, you know, at the time there were only a few dozen of, hoping that that would offset the gamma of the CRT, of which there were, you know, many thousands and hopefully many millions going to be in existence, to give a linear response, the yellow line. And so what we have here is the early sort of manifestation of a light to electrical signal transform, now referred to as an OETF, an optical to electrical transform. And then at the other end, the blue line, we have the electrical signal to light transform, an EOTF. And they're expressions that we'll hear about a lot coming up. So come the mid-90s, and every piece of equipment we're putting television signals through has got a frame store in, you've got to think to yourself, well, do we really need gamma anymore? None of the contemporary display technologies that we use, LCDs, OLEDs, plasmas, those kind of things, have a gamma that looks like a CRT. And nothing really needs gamma anymore. But gamma is still used, even in Rec 709, because it allows us to efficiently encode pictures, and it kind of reflects the way our eyes work. Our eyes are not a linear responding system. When a DOP talks about going up a stop of light, that's a bit brighter, but in truth, it's twice as many photons. It's twice as much light. And so there's no linearity in the way light levels increase perception of brightness. And the other side of it is that from an encoding point of view, so if we look at this, this is a spoofed kind of 32-level, 5-bit encoding system. If we encode a linear light signal, the steps are much more evident than they are on the gamma-encoded signal as encoded. So it kind of helps us. Gamma helps us in lots of ways, and it's not really necessary if we're dealing with contemporary display types, but we kind of maintained it for that reason. And so, you know, maybe 10 years ago, when camera manufacturers realised they could produce cameras that would put the dynamic range where it was needed, down in the dark parts of the picture and up in the bright parts of the picture, they could put the code values of the SDI signal where they would best give pictures that had punch. And of course, if you then look at that picture on a traditional TV monitor, it looks very strange, and you'd have to apply a LUT to it to make it look sensible. So even before the idea of high dynamic range television came on the scene for delivery, we were kind of getting used to the idea of high dynamic range cameras that could give the colorist a lot more latitude in how they graded the pictures. They could maybe dig into the blacks a bit more without seeing the noise immediately, or they could overblow the pictures without burning out the whites so much. Very much the kind of idea that film people are used to. But of course, UHD came along, and amongst the promises of UHD was high dynamic range. And it's kind of been late to the party. We've had kind of 4K pictures and wider colour gamut for a while, but UHD is the thing that really makes pictures sort of come to life, even to the degree that a couple of the American networks are now saying they won't go to 4K, but they'll implement HDR as part of their HD offering. And so that's becoming quite a thing now as well. Now, it is a bit of a crapshoot at the moment. In terms of production high dynamic range standards, we've got several. There's the BBC NHK system, hybrid log gamma, which has got lots of advantages. There's Dolby, Dolby Vision, Dolby PQ, depending on whether we're talking about D-Cinema or television. And that's typical Dolby trying to impose a license model on an industry. And then there's Sony S-Log3, as what you call it if you're shooting on an F55 or an F65. But they've extended it to be called, they call it S-Live, and they're hoping that will be a predominant production standard from camera all the way through, you know, live production, post-production, etc. And the thing that's worth remembering is that blacks can't be made any blacker. On contemporary displays, we can't kind of suck light back out of the environment. So black is black. I want my baby back. And you have to to be able to then get in that that wider dynamic range, you have to make the bright parts of the picture very, very much more brighter. So 100 candelas per meter squared is our very typical kind of Rec 709 point where we set our grading monitor. But when we're dealing with high dynamic range standards, 1,000 candelas per meter squared is kind of standard. 2,000, 4,000, even 10,000 candelas per meter squared, 100 times brighter than broadcast white as we've known it up until now, is what's talked about in the standards. The standards bodies have done what standards bodies do, and they've not really got behind any of these things. Rec 2100, which supersedes Rec 2020, which defines the wider colour gamut and those things, is the SMPTE document, and that talks about both HLG and Dolby as deliverable standards. DVB, the people who look after over-the-air broadcasts in this country, again have got behind both standards and ratified both of them. And it does seem that over the next couple of years, there's a lot to play for. You know, what's going to wind up as the predominant production standard? What's going to wind up as the predominant delivery standard? It does seem that HLG, the BBC system, is much better suited when things aren't optimal, when viewing conditions are not exactly right, or when you don't have full control over the pipeline. It seems that HLG is better suited to broadcasters because they can rely on the same broadcast plants that they have currently, only having to change their monitors, monitoring equipment, cameras, that kind of thing. But the SDI distribution, the over-the-air distribution, can remain the same. Dolby Vision brings a whole new bunch of considerations to the party. The Dolby CMU, the colour management unit, Dolby would really like you to buy one of those to have in your OB truck, to have in your presentation area at network, to have in your edit suite or edit facility. And so it is all to play for. But with these fine gentlemen before us, I'm going to kick off with the first question. And I suppose you all represent manufacturers who are very committed to an HDR future. What have you observed over the last year that you think points towards the future? Kevin, can we start with you?
Thank you. So, that's good. I think it's fairly clear that kind of HDR and HDR production, if you've been looking at it, watching it, observing it, as being like the Wild West, Phil described it as a crapshoot. There have been lots of tests, lots of evaluations going on. At the end of last year, the ITU published a document. It's another number, so BT2408. I'd recommend that you have a read of that document because it finally does lay out some production recommendations, because that's what everything is at the moment in here, recommendations. So it talks about how to set up the cameras, so the reference levels, how to work when you're in a mixed environment or standard dynamic range cameras, high dynamic range cameras, where maybe you have to deliver standard dynamic range as your main paying revenue stream, and HDR may be something that you're going to archive for a later date. So the nice thing is that we do now sort of have a standard coming together. That particular document is quite interesting because for the first time, both hybrid log gamma and PQ on a 1,000-nit display, they have an agreement of a reference level. They have a point where both are the same. It very quickly goes off in different directions, but we have a point where we can start with both. So I think the encouraging thing going forward into this year is the fact that we now have something that a lot of people are looking at, they're referencing, they understand where, how these limits have been set up, and we can move forward. So if you're talking to production and they're throwing it, we want to do it HDR, have a look at this document, see me afterwards, I can give you the link where to download it. It does allow us to move forward, which I think is something that all of us here needed standards to move forward to.
Yeah, I think, you know, the last 18 months, 2 years, looking, it's very much becoming defining of itself. There was talk about it, and it's the natural way for things to go. Because if we're looking at cameras, anything that is shooting a log has a foundation for creating HDR content. You know, ideally, you want to have a RAW capable camera that's going to be shooting 16 or 12 bit minimum, because we want to deliver a 10 bit. If we shoot 10 bit, then we have no overhead. We shoot 10 bit for an 8 bit deliverable, but 10 for 10 is a bit tight, and there's not really a lot of leeway within HDR. You know, it's quite similar to the change from SD to HD. You can't hide things, you can't bounce light. And when you're combining it with 4K, focus, things like makeup, wardrobe, costume, become quite critical because they behave differently. And the way you use light normally will be different. Something won't blow out. The skill, the nirvana of where I see it going is how the lighting can work in the story narrative. How can it enhance something that you're doing in the script? But we're a long way away from that. But it shouldn't be. There's a lot of complex terms around it. A lot of scaremongering and people unsure about it. How do I expose? What do I do? Well, actually, we're full circle back to filming production values. Engage in that way and not in a way where we've been confined to this 709 or 601 delivery entity. Shoot the thickest negative you can and acquire what you can, because then you can pull from that. If you acquire in a log format, you can take PQ from that, you can take a GLG from that, you can take whatever you want from that. And I think one of the things about high dynamic range that we need to look at, so we have over-the-top delivery, you know, so that's coming from Netflix, Amazon, and their system, all of their productions are producing that in 4K. And then we've got HD, HDR, just as good. You know, really, it's really the colour volume and the enhanced contrast that's it, enhancing it, not the pixels. But then what isn't mentioned is localised HDR delivery models. And I think this is ignored by people or not talked about, because you've got to think about, you know, retail HDR. Okay, you've got watches, bags, cars. These are the things that are pinging off lots of high spectral values, lots of really bright colours, and actually it's quite simple to deliver that within a closed environment. The screens are now there, iPads, phones, you know, we're able to view high dynamic range content in different ways. It doesn't have to be over the top. HLG is very good, it delivers it. PQ is very good for theatrical, but just think about how you can use that technology in a more localised way, because there are pitches to be had for commercial detail, where high dynamic range they might not even know about, it might just think it's something to do with broadcast. It's just about making pictures and the actual natural reflectance of the image that can have look more like reality.
Yeah, well, that's all well and good. But what happens if I haven't got the money to upskill? All that kind of stuff. You can use your, you can, a lot of the Sony cameras and other cameras have had sub blacks. We've had the peak whites. We haven't used that whole range of the sensor. We've always been compressing it down.
Yep.
So we can take a lot of existing HD cameras and still get a bang for buck. Converting
existing content as well. So exactly. It's not content you were already shot in previous years. We've got some content that we shot on F65 8 years ago. We remastered it.
Exactly. So it's not about just buying new.
Yep.
You can take a lot of the existing cameras and existing camera technology that you already have and upconvert that. Of course, you're saying you're not going to get the total bang of the total range of Rec 2020. But then again, no monitors haven't been. We're not going to get 100% of Rec 2020 on any monitors in the near future. Are we?
Kevin's point right here, because the whole camera pipeline and the acquiring side of image isn't really changing. It's the display endpoint. The reflectance that's coming off you is still the same. It's how we're reflecting that out of the screen back, and we can show more of that.
But this is one of the reasons where Lewis, I've got to agree with him, monitoring becomes important. And what he said about earlier on was about cinematic. It's getting back to them cinematic values of reflecting surfaces. So all of a sudden, if you're shooting or you're producing content, you need to be able to monitor in the space where you're going to finally deliver. I know a lot of the early, I think you were at the event where we were talking about Fleabag and a couple of the early HDR productions that they tried out. A lot of glinting watches, a lot of glinting zips on costumes.
And quite distracting from the actual script itself.
Yeah.
So being aware of how those, what would normally roll off or clip, can actually affect you'll pick, you know, you can suddenly in the background have a very bright, shiny car.
And that actually spent a lot of time that the colourists then ended up having to do work, spending days taking their elements out on SD and the HDR versions.
Oh, can I ask a quick question? So, in respect of your destination display, which is a solicitor's point, if you're delivering to a display device that you know already has 85% of RIP 2020, is that something you can do? You know, for example, the leader, can you sort of identify a colour space limitation, or can you limit to 85% of 2020 and then sort of QC to it? Is that realistic to?
We did a production with RTS in Switzerland for the Montreux Jazz Festival, which was, if anybody went to IBC, there was footage of this on Sony EBU stand. They set the cameras up how they felt through years of, you know, vision engineering, they set them up. But they played around. Now, there's been an introduction, Phil touched on it there with the optical to optical transfer function. With Sony's S-Log and Hybrid Log Gamma, you can't just apply the inverse to get the picture to look right. You have to apply what's known as system gamma, so it's basically a constant luminance. So if you want to see what it's going to look like at the end of the chain, you have to apply system gamma. Now, on my waveform monitor, we have the ability to switch that off and on. So you can look at the waveform monitor, see it in a log scale that we'd all be familiar with, switch on the system gamma, it will then turn to a nit scale or a candelas per square meter. If it's HLG, it will work as per that BT2100 document that talks about a 1,000 nit display. If you're working in a Sony SR Live environment, it will apply the OOTF that Sony published for their BVMX300. So you can sit there in an acquisition point and you could switch this over on my product and see where that waveform sits so you can optimise it so that you don't lift everything too high and everything becomes too bright, or drag it down too much where everything looks dark and moody. And somebody says, this was meant to be a jolly, happy, why does it look like some kind of Hammer Horror thing?
Which is the which is one of the issues with HLG, in the fact that you either have to do with display light conversion on the camera, and then the other conversion to do if you have graded content.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things of, if you end up showing that to a colourist, they end up seeing it going out. It never looked like that when I was going out. And this is one of the things that you've got to do when you've got to switch.
An interesting thing, we were plugging things together in a way that, we were talking about, you know, what's it been like over the last year. We were plugging stuff together, testing things. Those tools weren't available and accessible. So alongside the standards, what I would say is that there's more available tools now to measure, test, and understand what's going on in that colour pipeline, that delivery pipeline. You know, previously, there wasn't, and to be honest, not everyone was talking to each other. So I think that's improved somewhat.
I think it's fair to say that the revolution in the industry is such that up until HDR, you could take your television from home to the TV studio, and admittedly, you'd probably have to use an adapter, a converter to go from SDI to HDMI, but you could hang your telly off a studio camera, and what's coming out of the studio camera would look great on your telly. It's exactly the gamma that you'd be expecting. But now, you might be shooting S-Log, you might be post-producing in Asus, in Baselite, or in Resolve, or whatever, and delivering in a different standard, you know, to HLG if it's going to the BBC. And so Kevin's point about having that overall system gamma that shows you on set or in the edit suite or in the grading room a realistic sort of version of how those two strange gammas have interacted with each other. I think it's very valuable, and I'm not sure anybody else who does that. But Mr. Monitor Man, Victor.
I'll answer the fact, because you mentioned Rec 2020 as in the gamma, the amount of colour there. we were talking earlier with Lewis about the Rec 2020 is actually quite a complex gamut, in that the only things that can deliver it right now are lasers. And if you do that, they're very narrow band, and you end up with metameras. And if you sit here and we put a particular colour up, quite a few of you would not agree that it was the colour we said it was, even though you could measure it as being so. And that's because you've got like red, green, everything in between those two, not there, because the mixing of those two colours doesn't mix the way we anticipate it. Our eyes are, I hate the word design, but our eyes grew up to discover this beautiful broad spectrum of colour, and it's not the way these displays are working. When you get a display that's that's getting towards those primaries, that's getting towards 2020. But some of the conversation I've had with the colour scientists is about limiting it to something around a thing called Poynter's gamut. You mentioned Filmlight. Filmlight have their own version of this. And this is based on the visible spectrum that people can actually see. And as a pick up the points that guys are saying earlier, it's far better that 98% of the audience sees colours that they all agree, even if they don't discuss it, are the same thing, and that the highlight values in those things are not what causes them to... Have you got the app that switches it? No.
No.
I'll come back to that in a second.
It's only PowerPoint.
Where you get the... you get a luminance is something that adds to the plot or the scene that you're seeing, but it's not something... as in the case of, say, a 4,000 or 6,000 nit display that makes you look away because it's too bright and hurting your eyes. The blue and gold dress or whatever colours it was, that I've seen a lovely demonstration in a grading suite where that actually switches in front of your eyes just by changing the light. And that gives you the context of how malleable this environment now is. And so in this context, I think I've had several people say to me, including the BBC and the aforementioned company, that they think the domestic value for HDR is going to end up probably around 600 nits, 600 candela, that a thousandth's too bright. And my wife would agree with me because I took that monitor home, stuck Simpty bars on, turned it on in the back of the room, and she went,
you
"What the?
Tree,
the
oh
yeah! What are you doing? Look
at that! All the wine is Simpty bars."
That was Valentine's yesterday.
Sorry.
So I could completely ruin the ambience of the room with the thousand. Not nothing to do with the Simpty bars either. But it's like, you know, some of us are sad at night, you know.
And it's about colour volume as well, because, you know, even if you're using a smaller acquisition gamut, you know, so smaller primaries, because the limit is the clipping point, the whiteboard clipping is going from, you know, 100 to 600 or 1,000, you actually are increasing the amount of colour you can show there, because, you know, when RGB comes to 100%, it clips to white, but actually those colours extend beyond that. If you film a stained glass window, for example, or something, you know, depending on where the light is, you will have things clipping. I don't know if you've got that diagram, there was a Sony one, where they're showing the 2020 gamut, and then within that is the 709 gamut, but just showing that can also, it can also be increased. So just because the bucket of 2020 is there, you're not going to always fill it.
It's interesting, that Sony diagram, though. Be careful with it, because what it shows is the colour volume going all the way down to black, and it doesn't work like that.
No.
We don't perceive like that, that our light goes down to black. So if you have an OLED screen, and you take, say, a very dark red colour, and put that up, so go and film something red in a dark room, and then go and stick it up on that screen, you'll get a buzz off that red that is not natural, not normal, and you might have someone else going, "That's not red, that's brown." And someone else saying, "Well, that's gone white. What's going on there?"
Because
that's because it's stimulating your eyes in a way that your psychology is not able to deal with. That's another issue in that.
You have a better one, don't you? I think there is an ISO 3D one, which...
Well, the ISO LUT is normal. It's behaving the same way as a
diagram.
Oh, yeah.
You have one that comes down, and it's almost...
It's an inverted teardrop, essentially.
I should have referenced
it. But it isn't 3D. No, I don't. I know I gave me the time to try something.
It's right that it goes down there. It's just that you can actually see more colour. It doesn't clip at 100 anymore. You can turn, you know, Rec. 709 colours up to 600 or 1,000.
The other thing that we all know this from music, and we've not got used to this with video yet or visuals, is, you know, if you turn the volume of music up, if you go to a concert hall and listen to an orchestra, it's probably louder than most of us would listen to that normally. We're now getting that with visuals, where the energy coming off the screen is more like the energy we see in the real world, and we're actually delivering energy through that colour, which is giving it more vibrance. I have taken prototype 4K monitors out, I've taken prototype 3Ds out, and I've taken prototype HDRs. Only the HDR made people stop and go, "Wow, because the energy's there in the picture. It's giving them a buzz. Just like having high quality loud music. It's not that it's deafening, it's that it's got a high definition to it. And that is happening with colour now, and people are like opening their eyes going, "Ooh, that's really smart." Some of the material I've had people stop and go, "What's that?"
But this is where the perception of, well, do we need 4K? And this is what some of the American networks have decided, is actually, because we're getting that extra punch with the colour, we can just stay in HD. We don't have to reinvent the pipe.
Yeah.
We don't have to reinvent our whole processing. It's just a tiny overhead, well, 8, maybe 10% on the whole
let me ask you guys a question. How many of you have actually noticed the difference between 4K and HD? Yeah, when you're sitting in front of a screen. And what were you doing? Gaming or...?
Yeah, right.
Gaming is the only place you'll see it because the picture is rendered directly from the engine onto the screen. Otherwise, when you're looking at something that's normally captured or VFX that's designed to fit into a cinematographic scenario, no, you don't see it. With a screen, this screen, this is what? About 80 inches. So the front row is not going to see 4K. The resolution is too much. You can't see it. You might see some edges looking a bit smoother because your eye is moving, but the resolution of the screen is not going to be. So this should curve in.
Taking into account
the bottom like that, not go straight down. That's the way an OLED screen works and why it looks odd.
Yeah, so if you wake up at 3 in the morning and you look around your bedroom, that red dressing gown that's on the end of your bed, you see as grey. But the strange thing about OLEDs is that they don't collapse to black. They still maintain colour as they collapse to very low light levels. So OLEDs are perhaps it's a funny display technology, particularly for HDR. Which is why ISO went with the IPS panel, didn't they?
Yeah. We've run that. 1,000 to zero net IPS panel.
And the interesting thing is you're 1,000 across the entire screen, whereas other screens, and you'll see a lot of TVs claim to be X brightness, 1,000 nit OLED. Well, actually, it's smaller than a 10% patch of that screen that is 1,000.
Or they do local dimming and you get a little halo or something, or worse, a big square that one's bright and that one's dark.
And not to go against the Dolby Maui, but I use that screen quite a lot in the early days, 2000 is really a lot of haloing in that screen. So what this means is that around the local dimming LEDs, you're getting the halo, whereas you've got very good uniformity of light on that screen.
Does anybody go to IBC? A few of you. Did any of you see the TV Logic or Flanders screens there? So they were showing the TV Logic guys were showing a plant rotating on their scene in the dark, and I naively said, "Is this underwater?" And the guy said, "No, it's a studio set. It's all dry. But you've got a single light at 40 degrees to the optic. So why am I seeing all this lens flare?" And my colleague, who's Japanese, elbowed me and said, "Hello," which is the way the Japanese say halo. And I suddenly realised what I thought was fogging from this was actually from the local dimming around it. Now, it's me being naive about it. It's like, no, surely it can't be that bad. If I was a grader looking to grade this and want to say, okay, I need to define the edges around this plant, hang on a minute, I've just added edge enhancement, I've just put black on it, but nothing's changed. What's going on? Get the dropper up and go and see what the values are. Why is the screen telling me lies? And that's the ultimate. You want a screen you can trust and know that it's telling you what is going to be transmitted at the end of the equation, what you're going to deliver. And that was part of our equation when we were doing it. And I was staggered at how that picture looked. And I'm not doing TV Logic a disservice there. They should have done a better picture. In fairness, I have produced images that have been transmitted, and you live by that.
So, putting aside bad-mouthing other manufacturers, the Dolby PQ, BBC NHK HLG, got any thoughts as to where that whole kind of bun fight's going?
Well, let's go back to Dolby E. You know, we tried to broadcast things with metadata with audio, and it didn't really work out that well for us. How do we expect to be able to transmit pictures with metadata? You know, we always had the stereo pair that we could fall back on. And it's kind of, I don't see, you know, active metadata with HDR being anything broadcast. It's going to be a closed environment. So cinema. DVD player, that kind of thing.
Closed environment is relevant, you know, it's different technologies.
String, it would work, string.
Yeah, but most people that consume HDR in a closed environment,
yeah.
Netflix, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm not going to get bargain hunt in HDR.
Put FS4 up now, FS0, you can make your own.
In broadcast HDR, HLG, you know, you're going to see the real benefit of football, right? I don't know if you know, whenever you see a pitch that's half in shadow, half in light, thankfully that will be a thing of the past.
There's a guy in the scanner truck going like this, trying to keep
most everything.
Well, yeah,
more of these things where high, you know, the high brightness can affect what's actually delivered. You know, let's hope to see the Olympics. We saw it in HD. We saw it in 4K. You know, let's see what's coming with the World Cup and these big major events in HLG. I'm hoping my Sony TV will support it. So.
But then
so
you do need
the World Cup's in Bahrain.
So the problem is, then you need to, if you're making an SDR version, you pretty much need to have that guy who was doing all the camera racking shading an SDR version. And then people that don't have HDR.
At least you said that, Rupert. I held myself back on saying
it. I mean, I say for Egypt, I've been involved in a number of HDR productions where nobody wants to go down the route of 3D in a live environment again, where you have one side of the ground, the truck doing a 2D production, and the other side doing a 3D production. Those days are gone. We can't afford it. What people would like to do is shoot 4K, wide colour gamut, HDR, and drop down to deliver the HD SDR 709. Now, at the moment, the latter product is the one you get paid for. So therefore, people are very nervous about doing that one and hoping that it's all just going to shake down and fall out. We're getting close now. There are a couple of customers we've got who, I think under the right circumstances, with the right customer, will go for it, do it 4K, wide colour gamut, HDR, and use one of the tools that are out there to create.
We just sold to Syria in the Italy. And they're basically shooting all the next season, they're shooting them in HDR, and they're just doing a straight down conversion.
And I think that's the thing. Kevin Shaw, Courage Society, we're doing a similar session to this at Dolby, made a great statement that said, you know, for the past, you know, 10 years, it's all about, been about LUTs and lookup tables. For the next 3 to 5 years, it's all going to be about tone mapping and how we're delivering out of that. And the tone mapping algorithms do vary by manufacturer on the endpoint delivery, you know, at the TV level, but that's the most cost-effective way to be able to take this big negative and then take out those regions from it. You know, it's exposure compensation that we're bringing down from that filming production volumes we're talking about, bringing that in, automating that is
so you have colour as tone mapper, celebrity face or
something. Got a box.
The knob twiddler.
I think the other thing that's interesting is that obviously the HLG has come out of the BBC and NHK, which are probably now, correct if I'm wrong, the last of the broadcasters to have R&D to any degree. And they have worked this system through the whole broadcast chain. So it's not just post-production, it's taking it through transmission, it's taking it through the whole line delivered to the customer. And one of the comments when we've discussed it with them is, HLG will also work when you're then mixing between SDR and HDR programming in a timeline. You know, you've got your Sunday evening, you've got your Blue Planet 2, it's HDR, it's absolutely stunning. It comes to the end. What do? We squeeze it back, we put what's coming up next, comes a video, voiceover titles. To do that in a mixed SD HDR world is a real pain. PQ, talking to BBC R&D, they say it's virtually impossible to do that in PQ. Whereas hybrid log camera allows you to do it because it can work with both systems and overlay. You don't want too hard a junction between the programs. Some people, what's going on here? Somebody looks. So we're certainly seeing that HLG does seem to be now falling. Broadcasters are leaning that way. partly because they trust the BBC and NHK have done the due diligence all the way through the production chain.
I think we want to avoid a simulcast scenario, because how annoying is it when you realise, oh, I'm actually watching the Grand Prix, say, in the non-HD version on your TVs. You know, upscaling it and it's macro blocking, and you just think, oh, you know. So to have something where we can have that interchangeability and to seamlessly switch. The BBC are always worried about grandma's telly in the kitchen. You know, that's the lowest common denominator that they worry about, license payers, you know. So I think that's why it will be successful. And it's less dramatic change. You know, we talked before about it being 600, it's not 4,000 or 10,000.
So has anybody mentioned why HLG is obviously going to be better? You know, do you guys know that it's basically for the reference display? So basically your display decides the curve, not a predefined thing.
Your display will display as much as the curve can. Yeah. So HLG is fundamentally, it takes majority of 709 or SD86 curve with a tone, and then has a log shoulder. So if your TV can do 300 nits, for example, or 400 nits, which most LCD TVs can, you can probably get about 7.5-8 stops of dynamic range out of that signal. So the BBC could theoretically, just change everything over to HLG and send it out. And for those people who had a newer TV, they would see a slight increase in dynamic range. If you had a HDR TV, you would see a larger increase. But for those who didn't, it shouldn't make a difference. But
It is the one that seems to hold up best under adverse conditions.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I've watched the BBC sort of demo footage on inappropriate displays, yeah, and it does seem it's quite pleasant, you know. You wouldn't look twice at it. You wouldn't think, oh, there's something wrong with that.
And it dropped off. It was one of the first to the market around it, but then there was a big push around HDR10 and PQ and Dolby's machine of noise around that marketing. But I would say in the last, you know, 6 to 8 months, it's come back really strong. And even where they're doing the tests, putting the great things like anything that's natural history, which is naturally high dynamic range, great. It already looks great in SDR.
So why do we talk about, why do we hear about the firmware upgrades for TVs to support HLG supplement?
It's all about the flags that come as part of the HDMI signal from the set-top box or from the Blu-ray player. You've got to tell the telly what's coming up the pipe, kind of thing.
We talked about it earlier, that there used to only be one TV, which is the Panasonic 902X, that you could turn the EOTF to PQ manually and set the gamut manually. Everything else was looking for flags, and there wasn't anything spitting out flags, and it took a long time, a lot of little boxes in the background making these work. But now it's a defined standard. Before you made one, and we were testing, and I actually went to Dixon's, and they must have thought I was the craziest man in the world with this little case, about plugging it in to every possible TV.
Well, that was you.
Yeah, this guy was like that. He says, well, what's that you got there? I was like, it's a 7-inch HDR display. And so, because they don't have a lot of content in there either, they got very much dictated to by put it on vivid mode. Yeah. So,
and the 17-year-old in the cheap suit was happy for you to wander around behind all his tellies.
He was amazed. He was going that way. And at one stage, someone thought, I think I thought work there. And they're like, what are you doing there? He's just spent my money. I'm testing this out. And I was playing some Panasonic footage that day, which is a PQ thing. Oh, I remember this from the trading. Oh, you must be fun. I'm just invading my local curries to test it out, but it works now. It's dead easy.
If you have the opportunity to take the same content graded the two ways, so one graded for HLG and one graded for PQ, watch the PQ content in a cinema-type environment like that, then watch the HLG, and you'll see the PQ definitely has a bit more impact. Turn the lights on. Play the PQ and it looks flat. The shadow details have gone. You kind of lost the full impact of the picture. It still looks good, but the full impact is gone. Play the HLG, just as Phil says, it survives in the environment, because when you play the HLG back, because the shadow detail is brighter contextually to the PQ one, you get a better picture. You get something that's perceptually more recognisable as the original material that you're thinking about. So I think that in the hostile world, HLG will be the one that wins. It's highly likely that in controlled environments, gaming, cinema and home cinema, that PQ will probably win in that thing. And it will become like a hi-fi standard potentially in domestic.
On that. If you want to see any good comparisons on that, Vincent Teo from HDTV Test is a monitor calibrator. He specifically tests every single TV with the same content in Dolby Vision and in the HDR 10 HLG environment. You know, depends how geeky you want to get, but if you're looking for a TV, do watch that, because it does show how the tone mapping works on each of the TVs. It varies quite a lot.
Most of the domestic HDR10. So is this a big mistake?
They're all now all three.
Right.
So, well, every LG is...
HDR10 made it out a bit faster in the States.
Because it was free. So what happened is, so LG, they've nailed it. They've got Dolby Vision, HLG, and HDR10. They cover everything. They also make all the OLED panels for Sony, Panasonic, that are out there on 2017-18 TVs. But there was an update, just to come back to Rupert's point, which was when I was in Courage testing, that everything then had HDR10 and HLG. Dolby Vision is the one that varies because it's a licensed model. So Sony have promised it, but yet to deliver it. I'm really annoyed about that because I'm waiting for it.
And that's just the CPU built into your telly.
Sorry?
It's built.
Yeah, it's basically a decoder saying cha-ching. It's basically like saying, you know, one peak to Dolby every time, or whatever their model is. And then there's HDR10 Plus, which allows you to have scene-based metadata. So it says, okay, this scene is like this, display differently, which is how actively Dolby Vision does it. You can manually add it in. Now, Samsung are pushing this because I don't think they want to pay the Dolby licensing model, but fundamentally it would be the same.
And they've got Amazon
back. Yes. And one thing I thought was, how do they get the metadata? Do they just watch the Dolby Vision one and cut the paste
Well, just in case anyone wants to talk about how you actually get the Dolby Vision metadata, you know, out of your baseline into your telly.
It's a bit down in the weeds, there is this concept of dynamic metadata that has to travel with every frame of video in a Dolby Vision environment, and Dolby CMU, which is a computer, a box that Dolby will license, is the thing that supervises all that. And it has to derive, I can't remember how many parameters per frame, max 4, max CLR, what else is covered by the Dolby Vision?
Yeah, I think there's 4 within there. If you look even within Resolve, you can see that metadata that can be added within there. And I think Final Cut 10 have just added.
So grading and editing packages know about this, and they know how to derive that data. And essentially, depending on your workflow, if you're in a live video environment, like cameras into an OB truck, you have to have a Dolby CMU managing the data for you. If you're in the confines of a comfortable grading room, then Baselite or Resolve can do that for you as well. But it is, like Kevin alluded to, a real live stream of metadata that has to live in synchronism with the video, because if it gets detached from the video gets delayed by a couple of frames because it's gone through processing, and they haven't done the same thing with the metadata, you're in trouble. So it's unlike HLG, which doesn't oblige the broadcasters to change their plants to any degree. They don't have to, you know, put in new playout servers or wait for a new satellite to be launched with different transponders on it or anything like that. It doesn't require any change of the system. It's compatible. The only changes required are the cameras at that end, the monitors in the middle, and potentially the tellies at the other end. Or even if you don't change the tellies at the other end, it kind of looks all right. You know, it's 9/10 as good as it was anyway. So that's the compelling thing for HLG and broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, the fundamentals is really the Dolby front of the fact that the television to which you're addressing your content knows what it can do.
That's right. If you deal with the metadata and make a better job of it.
The Dolby data and do the right thing precisely in the space of HLG, which will look okay, and it's a sort of a blunter instrument.
Yeah, it's like a dumb way of performing rather than actually here's prescriptive instructions of how you should do it. It's a mixed blessing because you will get better response out of the Dolby Vision deliverable, but it's not a reality for everything.
But then you've got a reliance on whoever mastered, whichever DVD or anything else, which then, and we've seen some of the early Dolby Vision DVDs, they're absolutely awful. See, they're not seen. They maybe set the whole thing once for the whole film. It's, there was a Superman versus Batman one, which is literally, you're expecting advanced metadata.
Yeah.
There is actually none.
And this is a famous scene.
They said it once, and then that's it.
It's a famous scene with Ben Affleck's shirt, which is basically the measurement of clipping that they show all the time.
So some of it is smoke and mirrors regarding that active metadata that it's always there.
I think AI, might improve in terms of tone mapping and this metadata. Train computer AI to be analysing images at that time, and over time it'll get better at making the tone mapping decisions automated. I've seen a few discussions on it. I think some people are embracing it, some people are denouncing it.
So we have a couple of, three customers who are regularly delivering HDR, and it's the Netflix and the Amazon, who are really placing onerous delivery requirements on facilities, and it's the BBC who are being very gracious and very helpful to the industry. Tim Bora, who's one of the engineers at the Beeb, who's leading the HDR efforts. He's been very helpful to us. So we do lots of monitor calibration. And the Sony X300, which is the monitor that everybody so far has been buying, although now with the introduction of the ISO, we imagine that will all change. I've calibrated quite a lot of X300s for HDR, specifically for HLG. And not only has Tim been very good in showing us where Sony's advice on calibrating for HDR is completely wrong, but he's taken the time to go around all the X300s that they have at the BBC, and he's profiled all of them. And he's figured out optimal calibration steps to make sure an X300 type display is right for hybrid log gamma. So, I can't speak highly enough about how the BBC have engaged with the industry to make sure that HLG deliverables are as good as they can be.
The ISO HDR monitor was actually developed in cooperation with the BBC and HK. They're the largest customer for it right now. And I brought a couple of Japanese engineers over to meet Tim and some of his colleagues. And with one of their lined up X300s, our monitor next to it, in the dark, one of the other engineers walked in and couldn't tell the difference. We were looking at the wildlife content that's rolling out there at the moment. And I think from a reference perspective, that tells a good story. I know that there are issues that Tim related to. I believe they're fixed in version 2 of the Sony's ROMs now.
No.
Okay. There you go. I thought they were fixed. So, but the LUT, from a monitor manufacturer's perspective, is not necessarily easy to implement. But once it's in and correct, it comes out very nice. It looks very good.
So just to add what Phil was saying there, Leader, we've been very fortunate with Japanese. We work with NHK. If you come out and have a look, we have a real-time vectored image with the CIE colour chart. That originally came out of a discussion with NHK, and we've then followed that through. We've been involved with NHK and the BBC with Hybrid Log Gamma pretty much from day one, and those initial ideas and thoughts. So our products sort of evolved and grown even to the fact, the standard I mentioned, 408. We actually had a software upgrade that put those presets in there before that document was published. So we have a very close relationship with BBC and NHK.
And those suggested marks are, just to allude to what we were talking about, 600 nits. They're about that safe area. Because anything over that is, you can become a distracting spectral highlight. And only if it is part of the narrative, having it in there.
Well, one of the big learning things that we had, we've been doing some testing with the BBC on Hybrid Log Gamma, was the archive. Dealing with content which isn't shot well. Dealing with content which has got noise in it. Because as soon as you start converting that, and you're exacerbating spectral highlights and changing, how do you cope with how much HDR? How much do you force something which is play school from a 1-inch machine? Do you actually push it all the way, or do you kind of back off this conversion? You're trying to work out, based on noise and the image quality, and you're talking about AI and that kind of thing, about perceptually backing off the picture and backing off the amount of conversion, especially on SDR to HDR conversion. And that's kind of been a big thing for us, because obviously pushing sports and pushing all these live environments, which you can shoot really great, what do you do with your archive? What do you do with all that bleeding tapes that are coming in from 1970s?
I think film and raw digital assets, we can great work with them, but what do you do with that SDR?
Well, I'm
sure the ground will evolve to deal with it in much the same way that we've dealt with 4x3 images in an HD, certainly about
SD to
HD. We'll decide kind of what
of the things is we've started giving the ability to start altering the LUT, so you can actually change the amount of conversion that you can do based in the picture, and that's on a case by case basis. So, you know, if you're on edited content, but if it's being played in from somewhere else, then it depends on where you're getting it from.
It's back to this word, isn't it? Sony uses this artistic intent.
Yes.
There's 20 people in here. We all have different artistic intent. You know, what should it look like? Yeah. There's a DOP shot it on day one. He's got idea in mind. The camera system. They've worked together. 20 years later, is it still looking like they envisioned it on day one?
And that's the thing. Remastering again. This same session, Kevin Shaw was restoring Bugsy Malone from the original film neg to an HDR deliverable. I can't. Was it? Obviously, 50-year anniversary of the film. He was saying it was interesting of how much they could bring back, and they had actually clipped some so that they could bring that back, but there was so much more detail that they could bring out, and I can't remember the director's name or DOP's name, but they were saying, you know, that's actually how I there it is, that is how I saw it, that is how I intended it, but other films that you might see come out remastered might interfere with, you know, if you did a HDR remaster or something.
Film's interesting because you get peak white on a film that is not restrained by an RGB primer. So that all the electronic devices have RGB primers, and white is 100% of the RGB primers. Whereas film, there's no resistance there. There is no, as you said, thick negative. Where there's white, there is no silver lying there obstructing the light. So white is, if that's what your RGBs is, white's up here. So we had dynamic range. Cinema, etc. So I'm expecting a lot of old catalogue movies to come back and look absolutely stunning.
Yeah, better than you'd ever seen them. The same again with anything shot on raw and digital camera. They've got that capability to go and do that, but there's this mid tier which I don't try to do. How did Play School look in
it? It looked rather awful, actually. One of the big things is we went out and we specifically went to the BBC archive and pulled out UMAT, archive D2, D3, and everything, and trying to upconvert them and go through all these different formats to see how they react to the whole, to show us how much of adjustment we actually do.
Where to draw a line?
Well, this is it.
Please don't go here.
I think bargain hunt.
Bargain hunt. You know,
hey. HDR Antique Roadshow would look fantastic.
So is Rastin a win, or is this frame rate good?
Temporal, you know, when you're increasing spatial resolution to make the maximum of it, you should really increase temporal. Otherwise, I was at Panavision DXL thing and they were showing me an 8K in 24p, and Keanu Reeves went, so that's Keanu Reeves. I went, I've seen it, he's very cross on the bike. But actually, when they're talking about increasing spatial resolution, they actually want to downsample it. And so, because you don't want to watch everything at frames per second, which is how you'd have to watch 8K to make the most of it.
Will not NHK do anything called interframing on 8K at 120 frames per second? So you get two.
It's going to be double frame, so it's going to be 60, so it's going to be 60 repeat frame, basically.
Sounds like Intellect.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's the good days of honest video.
For those of you who think when we move to 4 or UHD and 4K that Progressive was the end of interlaced, get ready, it could be coming back to 8K.
Well, it is there,
and that's a jolly good thing.
On two sample interleave, that is technically pixel level interlacing.
Yeah, but there's no motion between them, between the segments, is there?
The wheels still have to turn back.
So getting back to your thing, Victor, that potentially this opens up a whole new raft of filmmakers being able to reversion their films. Do we think George Lucas and the first three Star Wars films are going to be completely buggered up? Sorry, reversioned.
Well, they weren't shot on film, were they? They were digital.
Episode 4, 5 and 6 were shot on film. 1977, come on.
Yeah, so that restricted the first
one's film.
Episode 4, 5 and 6.
New Hope is the first one. The other ones were shot on F900.
That's right, yeah. HD cam,
which kind of song. They're not actually really Star Wars. There's only three real ones.
They can be remade, can't they? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right back to the...
Right the way back. But yeah, well, imagine what that would look like. You know, the thing is, it's interesting that in the new Star Wars is that they are using real props and real puppets and real people, unlike what they then did on the... How many?
Well, I think it might be Disney's dollar might have helped that as well.
Yeah, and how many cameos inside alien outfits can actors get?
But the problem,
members of the Royal Family.
One of the problems that we've seen in a lot of tests with HDR is where HDR goes too far.
Yeah.
So one of them was theatrical, so opera. We did some tests with the English National Opera. Great. Obviously, you've probably seen them in the cinema. They do 2K to the cinemas. They did some 4K tests, and they all look great. As soon as we tried to do it in S-Log and did the tests in HDR, everything went to pieces. Costumes looked awful. Sets looked absolutely awful. Makeup looked like it had just been smeared on. And everybody panicked because they thought, oh my God, we're going to have to spend 15 million quid on each of the productions to try and rebuild all the sets, rebuild all the costumes. So by using HDR, you are going to have to start looking at some of the finer points of actually shooting. And the DOP, and the to use the term lightly, is really going to have to earn their money. And especially where monitoring is concerned and trying to get the best out of these cameras.
And camera tests, as I touched earlier on, makeup, on costume, are very important. Because it's not only the luminance side of things where you're not burning out detail, also the chrominance side of things, and how will that makeup you've applied and that light you're hitting it represent in a wider colour gamut? Suddenly you may end up with somebody with a very clean tone to their skin, and older actresses where you would normally soften and blow out might become more difficult. might look more like reality.
But doesn't that affect the suspension disbelief? I went to MTG where they were doing an HDR 4K test for a channel, and they were showing Spider-Man, and it looked like, because it looked so real, and that's obviously great in a nature documentary, it looks like you're looking out the window, you're right there. But clearly, if it's a fantastic story, it's impossible to conceive of the world, and it looks like it's happening in your front room, that has a terrifically deleterious effect on the suspension display. But kind of crazy watching it. I think there's some real challenges.
The Doctor Who get behind the sofa kind of thing.
Those sort of fantastic stories, when they look too real, when they look like they're actually happening right there in front of you, you probably don't respond to them the same way you do when they're artificial, in that the sort of fact that the medium is not as real as it can be.
Right. I had exactly that, Richard. So I was watching Narcos on Netflix, lights down, and it would look too real. As in the depth of field,
everything was out the window.
I was around the back of the sofa.
But back in the day, I think our psychology will actually adapt it, because the first time they showed a train coming out, towards
the
Lumiere people
brothers,
were running away, and you also get that problem when you're using virtual reality, where I actually feel dizzy because your brain's not used to it. But won't we gradually, our brains get used to it?
I think there's also artistic intent. Like how you want the story portrayed, you now have a lot more control. And if you want that sci-fi thing to look gritty and real, like H.G. Wells' radio show where people start panicking and things, or do you want to make it look false and abstracted from the reality. It's an artistic context. You have more tools and ability now to make those choices than you had before.
I certainly agree there with camera marge. A lot of DOPs, that was all the discussion about how, where is that creative personality? And a lot of the making decision and going again back to film production values and using light, colour filters and creating that as much as possible on set so that it couldn't be too bastardised in post. And it seems to be an interesting conflict between colourists and DOPs and some great productions where they've been allowed to work together and some where they were excluded. And quite a lot of debate about where they should be. And, it's an end-to-end colour pipeline. They should both be involved. The colourist should be on set, but what's going on, and then the DOP should be in the colour.
It should also go right down to the design people, all three versions of design. Because, how's your set kind of behave now in this new environment?
You have to do camera tests on there. You have to have an HDR monitor to see what it.
And then that's a whole bunch of new production values coming up, and extra investment. It's like a whole layer of money that wasn't needed before.
I remember when Sky did the first HD set, a studio, and a screen on the floor. So they had to have the studio rescreen it because they looked like they were flat on the field.
Well, let me start. We were in Germany. It was a concert, a rock concert, and it was a HD SDR, but they were Sony cameras, so 4K monitoring was around. And for reasons, we just switched on basically the HDR piece of that, and they brought up the light. So this is where you have to get a lighting director in as well, because we were looking at the pictures and that, and you could see the areas basically around the stage where they run the cables. Because in SDR, you can't see them because it's black. However,
it's turned into black.
Yeah, but this is not black anymore. And because we were showing the guy who built the set and that, he said, "You see my bloody cables?
Oh, crap."
You're
getting me very worried.
he was saying, right, he said, "I've got to bear this in mind." If somebody turns around to me, he said, "I'm going to look good in the next meeting." And they said, "We're going to shoot this, we're going to film it in HDR." Because then I can say why. How I need to compensate. He said, now I'm going to have to drill holes, I'm going to run the cables underneath rather than just running them around the back of the monitors.
Yeah, it's definitely the shadows, the colour volume, that isn't just for the brights.
No,
it is actually really tells me in the low lights. There's a great shot in the Dolby uses a lot when they're showing in the cinema, with the Revenant, the camera is looking through a stream, flooded stream, and it goes through a shot on his plaid trousers, and the shot sort of picks up his cuff, you can see all the detail of the plan, pull up in the same shot, get the bright highlights off the water, the sun sort of flickers across it and chasing the other. But it's really noticeable that it's the trouser cuff that kind of catches your attention, you're seeing stuff in that sense you can see it in the other.
It's a bit deep, sorry to go this, but it's a bit deeper than that. I saw an unreleased bit of material in Dublin recently, which was a very simple a scene that would survive with the dialogue. In 709, the sky was white, grey. There was a strip of concrete behind these people, and that was just white there from the sunlight that was running. There was a guy in a military uniform. It was just dark. His face was correctly lit. There was a lady in front of him talking to him with a white blouse on. The HDR content, you had milky blue sky. You had some clouds in it, which were completely invisible in the other one. The detail on that concrete. But it's where I thought it started to get interesting. The colour of the guy's military tunic was quite clear, just as you would have seen it if you were there at the scene. His face was perfectly clear, and her blouse was not white, it was cream. So it's actually the subtlety of this, the energy in that colour is coming out far more. So simple things like cables running in troughs on the side of the stage and furrows on the way the set's been laid out. It's going to be one thing, but it gets to even into the subtleties of where, somebody might have sewn a bit of a tunic up in a way that now is going to be visible because it's going to come out with those details. So I think it's going to be quite a learning experience for those people who are doing these productions when they do it in HDR. And I think HLG will be more forgiving in that context than PQ. PQs based on absolute values in the OO, I think it's going to hurt people quite badly, and they're going to get back, look at the rushes and go, right, okay, let's reshoot that day, but we have a lot of work to do to get it right. You know, a lot of testing, actually, is probably the answer.
Yeah, I think people around HDR, people are talking about cost of HDR production and associated things. A lot of it, you're not getting paid for two deliverables. You know, and I think this is where HDR makes a lot of sense, because the cost investment for storage is, you know, if you're shooting log anyway, it's not a huge amount of increase for the increased dynamic range and color gamut that is compared from moving from HD to 4K. There's so much more data to wrangle there that, you know, it does make sense to consider that.
You kind of imagine the industry will breathe a collective sigh of relief when one network takes the lead and says, look, forget the 4K nonsense, we're going with HD, HDR. That's what really the consumer's like.
Yeah. Which is kind of what NBC in the US pretty much, you know, put their star wood and said, we're doing HD, we're not doing 4K.
And talking about SD archive as well. I mean, taking SD material off 4K is just...
I did some 4.3 SD HDR, though, just to prove a point, because it wasn't about the number of pixels or the aspect ratio, it was just about, you know, what you could work within that image. I think there is a high degree of marketing around 4K and around that side of things.
I think it's being driven by consumer display manufacturers. They don't. We as consumers do not replace displays at homes enough. I'm just as guilty. I've got a 10-year-old HD display. You know, we don't do it. We're quite happy with it. We run with it.
Well, they don't break down like they used to, do they?
No. There was a quote I was told that basically people replace tellies because A, they break down or they're stolen. And somebody said, well, why don't you put like a passcode thing into your TVs? So if it was stolen, it's no use to anybody. And apparently the display manufacturers refused to do that because that's probably about 60% of the sales of TVs that hit.
The biggest change on TV was the analog digital switchover. That was the biggest number of TV sales. You know, HD, you know, just happened to coincide with that. So I think we kind of went, oh, and then we had 3D stereo. Every TV was 3D. Now you actually struggle to find a TV with 3D support. And they're all now having HDR support. And it's interesting to see that it was UHD Premium, which was 10-bit, 1,000-nit, high percentage of DCI-P3. And now the Visa standard, they've brought out some more standards. You get HDR 600, HDR 300, which allow you to have the processing of HDR luminance standards, but at a limited brightness. I think it allows everybody to get on that HDR bandwagon. But it is, if you see the picture, you can naturally see it's better. It's got increased Z depth. It's pleasurable to look at. So I think we'll come to treat it like the internet and just take it for granted that you used to watch that. It's like if a 4.3 comes up on the TV.
So we've been guessing on for an hour and a quarter now. I'll finish up by saying I look forward to when the industry starts to get back into colourising things. I think that was a... if you talk about creative intent, that's where I am.
That's creative in a tent.
Yes, So if there's any further questions, otherwise we can move outside and get some coffee and such. Far away.
So right now I'm in my HD grading, knowing that my nice calibrated screen, no one who sees what I'm doing is ever going to see it as nice as this current nicely calibrated screen because of your granny's telly thing. You guys have terrified me into thinking that when we come to HD, the worst case scenario versus the best case scenario is going to be this massive difference. So how can I know that the picture will be basically good for the whole gamut?
Well, very, very simply, you need to run a consistent pipeline. And then what you deliver will sit in the right place. And then if one telly's over there and another telly's over there, they only get half the inaccurate view. Whereas if you run an inaccurate pipeline and you're here and someone else's telly's over here, they get a completely inaccurate pipeline. Yeah? So as long as you run your pipeline consistently and accurately calibrated and all your colours set correctly, then you know what gets delivered is going to be seen as best the device can deliver. So, and that's why a reference monitor is a reference, and Phil and Tim, similar people, go out and make sure they're sitting exactly where they're supposed to be.
In a way, a calibration becomes even more
important. Massively. Yes. And it's, yeah. You know, we hear, always hear this golden eyes, golden ears kind of thing, where I think Phil can probably tell you the amount of rooms that he's walked in with. Whites are yellow or green, or perfect. It works.
Yeah. Do not stop him.
I've seen it where you walk into a room and you're just like, how are you actually grading on this? Because it, clearly you're grading against a plasma, or you're grading against an LCD monitor, which the two just don't match.
You can't, for example, grade on a domestic device because you don't know what is going on in that domestic device between your signal going into it and the pictures you're seeing on it.
Domestic devices are made to make the pictures look good.
Yes, yeah. I was in a major production house in Soho. There was an X300, one of our CG318s, which is the smaller of the two monitors out there, and a large domestic television. And the head of engineering of this company was screaming at the guy at the other end, saying, I have turned everything off, you are still sharpening this image. How do I turn this black line off round the picture? And the guy's, I can hear the guy on the other end of the phone, there's no black line, we don't do that. You've got everything turned off, it's not happening. And he said, I've got two reference monitors here, they're not showing it, you're showing it. So you need to have a screen that tells you the truth. Because if it's not telling you the truth, you don't know what you're doing. Not you personally, you don't know what you're looking at the screen. You adjust it, you don't know what it's telling you. So you need something, you absolutely know where it's sitting, absolutely know what it's doing.
And just to add to that, it's also the signal that you're feeding into it. You need to take a baseband video signal coming from a PCI-based architecture, be that Thunderbolt or PCI itself, because the amount of times I see people connecting screens directly, and I've got a full screen preview, it's amazing. But you're getting a display there that's coloured by whichever OS you're using. There can be a gamma shift in there, whatever. You can change the target of that, and you know, but even in Final Cuts, that Apple's paper said you can do this, but it is not accurate. And somebody asked me, said, well, when's this going to change? Never. until that baseband video coming out of there is built into the equipment, which I can't see it being anytime soon, then you have to use that. I know it's an added expense, but you're joking yourself. And companies like AJ, Blackmagic, grown up out of that. There's a reason that is there.
The companies that do that, what you're just describing, so there's quite a few companies I work with that do their VFX and some of their effects like that with a workstation with a display card. They have written the software to control that display card. They have set it up with the right LUT on it and a calibrated pipeline all the way from the screen all the way to the content space. It's actually very complicated. I've had people say to me, Can you explain to me, because I used to work at this company and they were doing it this way. Can you explain to me how they do it? My answer is, I'm not a colour scientist. Are you a colour scientist? No. Right, well, the guy who did it in that company is a colour scientist. So ask them, because it's complicated.
And it's the drivers and the architecture that's talking to it. You can't just rely on the OS to do that.
But right now, you know, I've got my next calibrated screen. I'm using a TTAP. Right, and you know, I know there's going to be a lot of variation in what other people are going to see based on the environment, but is that going to be just massively exaggerated then in the future of HDR? Stuff like hybrid log gamma will try and make it look...
The screens, the variance will be the same because the screens will vary as much as they do in SDR as in HDR, right. Whereas within the active metadata side of things, it will be actively talking to the screen, telling it how to perform. So if the screen's in vivid, it will say, right, go into HDR mode, you're going into this gamut, go into this, and display this scene like this. So that's the blessing of the active metadata, but we've talked about some of the concerns and potential difficulties around that. But in terms of hybrid log gamma, the screens will perform how the screens will perform, which is just the same as how you feed it SDR. The screen will perform.
But having the accurate thing, have a look at the LIDAR scope because then that shows you actually what's happening with the colour from a more scientific perspective than just the perceptual.
I show you
walls
and all, which is typical colours.
I mean, getting back to your point about Apple desktop, there is always an ICC profile in the way. And even, I mean, if I look on the two displays that are currently hanging off this Apple laptop, you see all the millions of monitors I've ever hung off this machine. But, you know, they come with, you know, sort of 709 and P3. Oh, this is looking very good, isn't it? These are like genuine kind of proper broadcast and film type colour spaces. But if you take your Apple display and you turn it into SDI through a flat converter, even if you've got the Rec 709 profile loaded, that's what colour bars look like. And that's not pretty, is it? That's not right. So
you're going to redo that screenshot filter.
Yes, that's a Tektronix display.
It's currently available for like demo use.
So never ever trust the desktop output from a Windows PC. Windows you can get right with some care. Apple you never can.
Yeah.
You've always got to have an output display device like something from AJA or something from Blackmagic.
And be careful that Thunderbolt 2 doesn't carry a HDMI output, but it is just a display output also. It is not a baseband.
Which will have an ICC profile applied to it.
ICC profile on as well.
So, and I was trying to reinforce this to a manufacturer. So, we just plug it in here.
But theoretically, HDR as a delivery should be closer to what I'm seeing in the grid. Should be less various because the TV is actively trying to show it correctly rather than just taking.
Depending on the tone mapping algorithm of the TV.
So my vote would be to do it from the leader.
Yeah.
That's a more appropriate one.
Thank you very much. Nobody heckled, which is always nice. And you should talk to these guys because they've forgotten more about it than I ever knew.
Thank you very much.